Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Jimmy Buffett has his famous Parrotheads, The Grateful Dead, it's Deadheads, Insane Clown Posse, it's Juggalos, Bikini Kill, and more, they're Riot Girls. Even Wagner had his super following, not just fans, but a whole super fan subculture. My guest today, Nathan Raven, spent 2 years following jam band Phish and its fans across the country and flocking with the Juggalos to the hip-hop duo Insane Clown Posse's wild annual gatherings. Looking to understand the world of musical superfandom, it rocked his world. This hour on Point, inside music's superfan subcultures. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation never ends. Is, was that you in there? Phish fan, Deadhead, Riot Girl, Juggalo? What's it about? Community? Common dreams? Just the music? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Or join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We will hear in this hour from punk rock star Bikini Kill's Kathleen Hanna on the Riot Girl world and music critic and former classical music writer Alex Ross on the great days of super fandom around Liszt, Paganini, Wagner. But first, from Chicago, Nathan Raben joins us, author of the new book, You Don't Know Me, But You Don't Like Me, Phish, Insane Clown Posse, and My Misadventures with Two of Music's Most Maligned Tribes. For 16 years, Nathan Raben was head writer at the AV Club, The Onion's Entertainment Guide, and now is a staff writer for the new film website, The Dissolve, from Pitchfork, which launched yesterday. He's author of The Big Rewind, My Year of Flops, and most recently, Weird Al, the book with artist Weird Al Yankovic. Nathan Raben, in Chicago, thank you very much for being with us today. Welcome to On Point.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Wonderful to have you. Were you a natural-born follower, subculture member, or what drew you in, Nathan?
No, totally. I think like all teenagers, I was an inveterate follower. I was just kind of looking for somebody to lead me wherever that might go. But, you know, I was a pretentious kid, so kind of my gods were, you know, the Roger Eberts and the Pauline Kales and the Greil Marcuses. It wasn't until much later in life, until I had evolved or devolved, until that I developed this, you know, sort of insane fascination with these musical subcultures.
From Pauline Kael to the Insane Clown Posse and the Juggalos, the name for its followers. I mean, this was a really interesting read, following you into deep in the sort of mesh of these cultures, you know, your first reaction to what you found there and how that changed over time. You got two very particular groups here, Phish, we were just listening to there, and we'll hear a little bit of Insane Clown Posse. But it wasn't exactly the music that was your first interest here. It was the, as you say, in these two, the maligned tribes around them. What forms those tribes? What did you find in the tribes?
Well, I think I like to quote Violent J, especially over the NPR airwaves.
Half the duo of Insane Clown Posse, yeah.
Definitely, definitely. As all your listeners undoubtedly know.
Undoubtedly.
He along with Shaggy Two Dope, are members of Insane Clown Posse. Yes, his partner. And he likes to say the colder it is outside the circle, the warmer it is inside. And what he meant by that was Insane Clown Posse has kind of a reputation as the most hated group in the world. And all of that anger and contempt and resentment that they get from the culture outside, I think, forms this tighter bond among them. It kind of bands them together. It gives them this identity, this sense of self that I think is very powerful, even if it leads them to be as the title of my book suggests, maligned by a lot of society. I think the same thing with Phish, where it's kind of this culture. It's not just a show. It's not just music. Every Phish concert, I think, has the possibility for transcendence, for seeing something or experiencing something that you will never see again. And drugs play a role sometimes. One might argue it possibly did in my experiences. But I think a lot of it has to do with the community and with the music itself, which I think is at the core of everything, even if it can be overlooked in a lot of instances.
The colder it is outside the circle, the warmer inside. Until you're in there, it can be pretty hard to understand what's going on. Here's a little bit of Insane Clown Posse out of Detroit. As Nathan Rabin says, this is Down with the Clown.
How long will the Jackalos be down with me? How long till they forget me? Check it out. What if I threw another fire head and his name was Violent Ed? And he headbutt me every time I cussed. I would need two microphones when I bust. Or what if I sold out like a brute and took the makeup off? Put my ugly face on the album cover. Cross that dough, yo, I'm a juggalo. So don't forget me like you did with my new dial.
I'm a juggalo. It's Singing Clown Posse, ICP. And, you know, it's not about the love of music critics here. We've got the GQ magazine putting out a list of the worst hip-hop of all time. And right there above Vanilla Ice and MC Hammer, they put Insane Clown Posse. Maybe that just makes the circle grow tighter. What's the vibe? What's the culture, the subculture there, Nathan?
Well, I think, you know, there is at the Gathering of the Juggalos, there is this...
The big annual get-together.
Yes, the annual Festival of Arts and Culture, as I like to refer to it. You know, there's a sense of incredible freedom there. There's a sense of, you know, the freedom from judgment, freedom from shame, that you can be whoever you want to be. If you want to be naked, if you want to do backyard wrestling, you know, if you want to be out of your mind on drugs, you can do that. There's just this sense that, you know, as a juggalo, you have this freedom that doesn't really exist anywhere else in the world. And Insane Clown Posse have been brilliant about branding and about building a community and building a family. And I think The Gathering is part of that.
Could you make vivid what that looks like? I mean, you write on a primal level. A lot of people find juggalos, these Insane Clown Posse followers, just plain gross. Why?
Well, I think there are a number of reasons for that. I actually did Jesse Thorne's podcast, Bullseye, recently, and part of it has to do with the music itself. One of the great things about promoting this book is forcing people to listen to the music of Insane Clown Posse, which is delightfully sadistic of me. And we were listening to one of their clips, and Jesse got this look of just visceral disgust. This looked like it was upsetting him on like a primal
level. Why? Describe why.
Well, I think because the music is very silly and very kind of assaultive and kind of, you know, violent and over the top and goofy.
But you're
and
saying the juggalos are just plain gross. Your words here. Why?
Why? Well, I didn't say that the juggalos were gross.
Yes, you did.
People,
a lot of
I think people find them.
Yes.
I said people find them.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I think part of it is one of the sort of cornerstones of Insane Clown Posse's concerts is that they spray their fans with Faygo, which is off-brand soda. And it's kind of this ecstatic climax to these sort of riotous, you know, sort of vaudevillian shows that are really just kind of rich in spectacle and comedy and goofiness. And their fans also dress up as clowns. They put clown makeup on. So there's something very kind of visceral and physical about it. At the Gathering of the Juggalos, you have 12,000, 15,000 people out in the middle of the woods with very few showers. So you have a lot of people on drugs, a lot of people making sweet, passionate love, a lot of people, not a lot of people showering. So I think just on a visceral, physical level, people are kind of creeped out by them. I think there's also a lot of classism, sort of endemic in this hatred of Insane Clown Posse. I think a lot of it's also just kind of lazy and cheap. I mean, you spoke of that GQ piece that described them as being
the worst
rap group in the world.
Right.
They are not GQ, and I think that's a beautiful thing. And I like the writer who does that, but like his I don't know, his three sentences literally contain no actual criticism. They say they use a lot of profanity. Vanilla Ice is at their gathering. Like, they're a bunch of goofs. There's not any actual criticism of that. And I think a lot of people who condemn juggalos, a lot of people who condemn Insane Clown Posse have never actually listened to the music.
The duo
it took
grew
me
up,
a long time to get to it. Yeah, but when
they grew,
I did, I was very pleasantly surprised.
The duo grew up poor. Is there a kind of, you said a class issue, is there a poverty bond In part, among the
Juggalos.
Well,
and one of the wonderful things about Insane Clown Posse, from my perspective at least, is that they rap about being poor. And they rap about being poor in a really proud, unabashed way that makes being poor seem really cool. You know, there's a reason why they rap about Faygo rather than, you know, Cristal. And that's because Faygo is really, really cheap and anybody can buy Faygo. So I think that kind of bonds them. And it also kind of makes it a lot easier to kind of have them be these punching bags, to have these be these sort of default cartoon sort of stand-in for white trash or rednecks or, you know, whatever people think of as being the worst white people in the world. What people generally think Juggalos are. And, you know, I was delighted to find that it's a lot more complicated and a lot richer and, you know, a lot more wonderful than the hype would suggest.
We're going to come to Phish fans. Look at them. You put them at a different end of the spectrum, at least in terms of stereotype.
Yeah, definitely. I think they kind of also have a lot of criticism. I think they kind of have become sort of stands for the public's anger and contempt and resentment of hippies. I think there's kind of the stereotype of Phish fans as just kind of being these burnouts and then these potheads and these people who contribute nothing to society but just like listening to this noodly interminable music. And I found that, you know, that's both reductive and unfair. And again, the truth is a lot more complicated and a lot more interesting.
Nathan Raven says he was afflicted when he began his superfan subculture journey with the curse of self-consciousness. He lost it in the course of writing the book. He says, bashing my skull open, I lost all those pretensions, all the ironic distance, learned to love the music on a really deep emotional level. Nathan Raven, stand by in Chicago. The new book is You Don't Know Me, But You Don't Like Me, Phish, Insane Clown Posse, and My Misadventures with Two of Music's Most Maligned Tribes. We're going to look beyond them, way beyond them in this hour. We're going to hear from Kathleen Hanna of Bikini Kill. Listeners, you can join us. Can you understand what brings out the hardcore, go-anywhere, live-the-life, must-have-the-music fandom of superfan subcultures? 800-423-8255. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Never will ignore ya. Got a hot plate in a twig, we're gonna pour ya. Quartz on the grill, plays on the 1-2. Hit a run, hit a dead, have fun too.
I'm Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about musical cults, super subcultures, music's super fan subcultures. Phish fans, deadheads, juggalos, parrot heads, riot girls, and the bands they loved. Nathan Raven is with us from Chicago. He's author of You Don't Know Me, But You Don't Like Me, Phish, Insane Clown Posse, and My Misadventures with Two of Music's Most Misaligned Tribes. We're going to look well beyond those. Kathleen Hanna, the great Kathleen Hanna of Bikini Kill, will join us in a few minutes. And later in this hour, we'll talk with the great classical music writer Alex Ross. Take it all the way to Liszt and Paganini and Wagner. Insane Clown Posse behind us right here with Juggalo Island. And you can hear it right there in the lyrics. We got a place for you. Never will ignore you. Got a hot plate and a drink we're going to pour you. And you're in, well, in their case, the Juggalos. You're in the subculture. You can join the conversation this hour. Can you understand what brings out the hardcore, go-anywhere, live-the-life, must-have-the-music fandom of superfan subcultures? Have you been there, done that? Who did you follow? Why? And how far did you go? How deep? Did you join the caravan for Phish, the Grateful Dead, ICP, you name it? 800-423-8255 is our number, 800-423-TALK. A little bit of the Phish experience that has put so many on the road. This is Wilson, live by Phish, concert in 2011 off their album A Live One. fish. And you hear the depth and passion of that crowd there live. Ted in Cleveland, Ohio. Ted, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. This is my favorite subject, the band Fish. I would just like to say that the reason that they're so great is they're fantastic musicians, absolutely fantastic quartet. They have a respect for their fans, and we have a respect for them that I think is unmatched. They don't, you know, they don't jerk our chain as fans, and I don't think we do that to them. And the other thing I would like to say is you know, it's almost like an inside joke that Fish fans are in that no one else is in, while, you know, all these other bands charge $250 plus for their tickets. Fish keeps it low, keeps their ticket prices low. And as an editorial that Nathan probably knows about, I have to suggest anyone out there that wants to really learn what Fish is really like, listen to their Fall 97 tour. It's the best thing that's ever happened. So that's about it.
Hey, thanks. Ted, I appreciate that. Let me read what Nathan writes here and get your reaction as a fan. He says, Fish isn't a band, it's a way of life. It's a name that conjures up images of lost children with scruffy beards and tie-dyed shorts, dreadlocked white women habitually clad in flowing dresses. Is that your Fish fan world, Ted?
I don't know from that. I mean, I know that that exists. I would say that there's a lot of, like, heavy drugs on tour now that weren't really part of it when I was younger, so that's a little disappointing. I would have to honestly say that some of the crowd has gotten a little rough, and I'm married and about to have a child, and I don't really know if I really trust my wife being in the crowd these days. But that aside, the music is still amazing. There's still amazing moments, and there is nothing better than a Mike song, Hydrogen Week of Prague, to open a second set. So there you have it.
And out come the Fish fans. Ted, thanks. One more right here from Oklahoma. UConn, Oklahoma. Josh, you're on the air.
Hi, John. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Actually, there's a, you know, you're on the subject of bands. There's a band that's been for 20 years. Their name is 311. And their positive message has not only fans creating Facebook pages, you know, in regards to the band, but also when, for example, a guy that came on the page and said, hey, just got done watching a 311 concert. I got called from my grandpa, you know, let me know my dad had is in hospice with stage 4 cancer and was having trouble breathing.
Yeah.
And just the positive feedback from everybody. Nobody was talking about the band itself. Nobody was saying, what a great concert. Everybody was there as like a support group and saying, hey, man, we feel for you. We're there for you. And I think that's probably one of the best things about having these fans considering your message. You know, I'm not a fan of Insane Clown Posse, but as far as a band like 311, it has brought me from a very negative life to a very positive life. And I think music has a very strong message when it comes to something like that in that regard.
Josh, I love hearing that. A community, regardless. I mean, you got a different, you got 311, 311, you're following there, but that community factor can be so important these days when people are fractured in so many ways, even around a band. Matt in Boston. Matt, thanks for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a psychologist. I'm a lifelong Deadhead and Fish fan. And I think one of the major factors that I've noticed is that there is a level of spirituality of the fans that really get into it. Yes, they come for the music initially. They come for the fun and the party. And I disagree with the last caller. I don't think that the drugs are any more prevalent now than they used to be. I think you go to any rock concert, you're going to encounter alcohol and drugs. That's just a fact. Yes, these bands have, you know, a reputation as being more involved. But I go not just for the music. I go because I have met a lot of people through social networking who, you know, I have a year-long relationship on the computer, and then I get to meet them in real life, and they are who they said they were. They're an honest group. They care about each other. There's a kindness out there. And, of course, that's a generalization. There's going to be out there people that are going to rip you off and sell you fake tickets. But that's just part of life. But I think,
hey, Matt, you're a psychologist. Do you find mental health encouraged here? Or are you going there?
Frankly, I see both sides of it. You could go there, not get involved with a lot of people, take a lot of drugs, and just kind of space out on the music. That's a smaller subgroup. But I think the larger group, especially now, 30 years down the road, you know, yes, there are some younger people, but there's a lot of people my age, mid-40s, you know, early 50s, that this is what we did when we were kids, and all of these bands have either, you know, faded away or broken up for a period of time, and Phish just reunited in 2009.
Yeah.
And I think for a lot of us, it was a feeling of, we thought we had lost something very important, but it came back, and it has come back slowly but surely, and frankly, I think they're playing better than they ever have before. They seem happier, more internally connected. Trey Anastasio, the leader of Phish, went through a drug addiction, and he is now clean. The band is just, you know, they're firing on all cylinders, but still, I would not go as often as I go just for the music. I go because I see a group of caring people. I get tickets for face value and under on a regular basis. And if something were to happen, my car were to break down, I ended up without a hotel room. That actually happened to me last weekend at SPAC up in upstate New York. My reservation got messed up. I had five people immediately saying, you can come crash on our floor. We have space for you. Don't worry about it.
You're in that circle of warmth. Matt, I appreciate your call very much for that. The caring people that you find there, even the spiritual, of course, before Phish, the Grateful Dead and Deadheads. You talk about them, Matt. Here's Franklin's Tower Live, 1981. Roll away. Grateful Dead, 1981, Franklin's Tower live there, and of course the Deadheads. Nathan Rabin, you hear our caller there say, look, it's not only community caring, and it gets all the way to the spiritual with him. Did you find that, Nathan?
Oh, definitely. This was, my book is partially about musical subcultures, partially about Phish and St. Clown Posse, but it's partially about sort of my spiritual and psychological journey. I had a bit of a nervous breakdown over the course of writing this book, and I experienced this concert, this Phish show in Bethel Woods. It's kind of the cornerstone of my book. And it was a profoundly spiritual experience. I felt like I had this epiphany, this spiritual epiphany that kind of allowed me to both understand Phish and its fans and, you know, the whole essence of what I was doing better, but kind of allowed me sort of the strength to kind of go on with it. And yeah, I totally understand and empathize with what the callers were saying. And I think for a lot of fans, what they find in other fans is a surrogate family. And that is something you hear at the Gathering of the Juggalos over and over again. People just chant family, family, family. And it's even more poignant because a lot of these kids come from broken homes. They don't know their dads, they don't know their moms, their parents disapprove of them, their friends disapprove of them. So to come to this place where being a juggalo is not only accepted, but it's celebrated, is incredibly powerful and healing for them on a profound level.
We're going to hear in just a moment from Kathleen Hanna, American musician, activist, writer, former lead singer of the punk rock band Bikini Kill. Back in the Riot Girl days, she's got a lot more coming up. We'll talk about that. But here she is, 1993, Rebel Girl. Kathleen Hanna here. Yeah, 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 was the album. Kathleen Hanna and Bikini Kill right there, 1993. Sasha Ferre Jones at The New Yorker calls her one of America's greatest living rock performers. Former lead singer there, former front of the band La Tigre. She has a new album coming out in September as part of her new project, The Julie Ruin, entitled Run Fast. She knows a thing or two about potent musical, cultural subcultures then and now. She joins us right now, and we're so honored to have her, Kathleen Hanna, in New York. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Nathan Rabin's writing about Fish. He's writing about Insane Clown Posse. Now, you experienced a movement of your own. It was bigger than just for Bikini Kill, but Riot Girl was all around you. What's the power of that subculture around the musician, or did the musician somehow create it through what they project, Kathleen?
Well, I think a big part of the Riot Girl movement and a big part of what My Damn Bikini Kill was trying to do is actually really similar to what Nathan talks about in his book, is breaking down the barrier between the fans and the performers, you know, which is actually quite a radical idea, quite a disruption of hierarchy. You know, I would find the difference being that, you know, Nathan was speaking about, you know, people who are coming from broken homes who are looking for a communal family experience. And I think that was very much present in Riot Girl, but there was also, there's women who, the nuclear family itself is just broken. Our position within the family is broken. And so we're looking for a new kind of family. We're looking to create a new kind of family that includes our politics within it. Many of us went to the punk rock scene looking for that community, and all we found was more sexism and more racism and more homophobia. And so we tried to kind of split that apart and make something within it that made sense to us.
Was the Riot Girl subculture then in the end effective in your view, Kathleen, as an incubator, as a sort of a, you know, pool of nutrients for a political perspective or push?
Yeah, that's what I hope. I feel like a lot of political change starts kind of at the cultural level, where we start saying what is possible, what could be possible. You know, it's always the arts that point to, you know, crazy new ideas that people are like, whoa, really? You know, women could be in bands and there could be as many women in bands as men, or, you know what I mean? Like, there's always these things that happen that start germinating ideas, and then hopefully that rises up a little bit and someday hopefully becomes legislation and equal rights.
You were so bold, so out there. Did you see yourself as a cultural leader when you were singing in front of Bikini Kill?
Absolutely not. I saw myself as a part of a community, and I was doing what I love to do, and I felt very lucky and very fortunate to do it, but I felt very much, I felt really confused by the whole idea of myself as a leader, because that isn't how I perceived myself at the time. And that was actually something that was quite disruptive to, I felt, the movement or whatever, you know, punk rock feminism, was that I was held up as like this leader or something, and I was just some girl in a band.
And yet you were potent as can be, and community definitely grew around you. Now you've got the Julie Ruin coming out. Where are you headed with this? We're going to hear a little bit from it. Where are you going with it, Kathleen?
You know, I'm 44 now, and I want to make music, and I don't want to try to write a feminist anthem every day, and I don't want, I just want to write what I want to write, and I want the freedom and the space to do that, and I really trust that my core values will come out in what I make, and I'm really fortunate that, you know, from answering tons of fan mail for the past 25 years, like, I do have a core group of fans who care about what I do, even though I'm not, you know, 20 years old and the bright, young, shiny thing. And there's definitely been a similar community, not as strong probably as Fish or the Grateful Dead, but around us. But I'm really fortunate that there are kids who I was writing to when, you know, I was 20 and they were 16, who are still coming out to see what I do. So I feel really lucky about that.
Kathleen Hanna, if you were still 20 in this world, 2013, where would you push your energy today to build a community? Around what political, cultural issue, poll?
Well, I definitely would be working much more towards discussing intersectionality in the way that race, class, and gender and sexuality intersect with each other politically and socially. And I think my main issue would be hunger, to be perfectly honest. I think it's despicable that so many people are hungry around the world and that there's enough food to feed everyone. And if I was 20 years old, my blog would be about hunger. And that would be probably what I'd be singing about.
There it is, straight from Kathleen Hanna. Her big new album, Run Fast, comes out this fall with the Julie Ruin. Here's the first single, Oh Come On. Kathleen Hanna, absolutely terrific to have you with us. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Nathan Rabin, author of You Don't Know Me, But You Don't Like Me. Please stand by there in Chicago. We're talking about music's super fan subcultures. Listeners, are you in one? What comes out of these subcultures? 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about music, superfans, subcultures, fish fans, deadheads, juggalos, parrotheads, riot girls, and the bands they loved. You can join us, 800-423-8255 is our number, 800-423-TALK. Nathan Rabin is with us. He's author of the new book, You Don't Know Me, But You Don't Like Me, Fish, Insane Clown Posse, and My Misadventures with Two of Music's Most Maligned Tribes. Great excerpt of the book at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can join us. Were you a riot girl screaming proud in the front row? Fish fan? Insane clown posse? Juggalo? What's it all about? Is it chasing a dream? Community? Acceptance? A better world? A different world? Do these subcultures create an alternative universe? Have you been there? 800-423-8255. Nathan Rabin joins us from New York. Alex Ross is going to join us a minute to take us back when maybe there was a kind of equivalent in the classical music world around Liszt or Paganini or Wagner. Nathan, we've got all kinds of response here. I mean, right off the bat, we have listeners saying, hey, are there some subcultures too popular to be called music subculture that fits your model? Maybe parrot heads themselves, they're so mainstream. Does it still work, Nathan?
I think if you have a chain of restaurants the name of your most popular song, and you have, say, over $300 million, you've probably foregone the right to call yourself, you know, kind of a subcultural figure on any level. And I think there are definitely, you know, super fans. And Jimmy Buffett. And he was actually one of the people where my original idea that was going to follow, you know, six or seven different subcultures. And then I realized, like, oh, I would need all the money and time in the world in order to do that. Kiss was one of the people that I thought about doing. Actually went on the Kid Rock Chill and Mouse Cruise. So, yeah, I think he definitely is somebody who has insanely devoted, committed, maligned fans. But, yeah, I don't think they qualify as a subculture by any stretch of the imagination.
Here's a listener who writes, listening to your show, I Googled Insane Clown Posse. The first thing that struck me is that they are two white performers in blackface making fun of a black music genre. What about that instant reaction to Insane Clown Posse?
Well, that was actually in the 1990s. Violent J writes about this in his book, Behind the Paint, which is almost 600 pages. And actually,
and they are
surprisingly
white.
Fascinating. Yeah. And that was one of the, well, they're dressing up in clown makeup. Mm-hmm. And I think there is a big difference between dressing up in blackface and dressing up like a clown. And throughout the 90s, there was this, I guess, widespread misconception that they were racist and that they were doing this to make fun of black people. And that just wasn't the case at all. They've actually recorded a number of anti-racist songs. They've taken, you know, a very firm anti-racist stance. But I think it also corresponds to people's conception that, you know, if you're a poor, uneducated white person, you're probably racist. So I think that kind of conforms to stereotypes about poor white people and, you know, people without educations that they're racist. Yeah. And I find that, yeah, that's just not true. And you go to the Gathering of the Juggalos, A, there are a fair number of black juggalos, and B, 80% of the lineup is African-American. They have this sort of deep reverence for hip-hop. So they're not making fun of it. You know, they're just doing their own very strange variation.
Yeah, here's another angle. Zachary writes on Facebook, "I can identify with the Insane Clown Posse following. To me and my brother," Zachary writes, "it was an unjudgmental group of younger people who had a tolerance for any outcast or teenager that didn't quite fit in with other cliques. I've since grown out of that phase in my life, but have very good friends that I sympathized with in those days." I mean, this was is a refuge for many people, Nathan.
Oh, totally, totally. I think, you know, a lot of people have very, very difficult lives. I kind of write about them in the book. You know, they have very, you know, crappy jobs. They have dysfunctional home lives. And they find this escape, you know, this world of fantasy and imagination. And again, it's not just music. It's, you know, the gathering. It's this community. But it's also this spirituality. I mean, they have this concept of the dark carnival that played out over about 10 years, you know, where they kind of sort of their own religion. I mean, it's this whole universe. It's not just music. And I think that is really powerful to people who feel, you know, on the outside looking in. And I think it was actually powerful to me when I was writing this book. Mm-hmm. And I was also feeling kind of alienated from myself, from the world around me. And there was something just kind of weirdly comforting about the lack of judgment that I found among juggalos, especially at the gathering.
I mean, that whole dynamic we know from religious talk of "I was lost, now I'm found." Dave Diamond writes on Twitter to us. He says, "Maybe this is the modern replacement for religion." What about it, Nathan?
You know, it's funny. I actually just saw the play Book of Mormon, which, speaking of things that are more culturally accepted, and, you know, one of the kind of underlying themes of the Book of Mormon is that a lot of mythologies, a lot of religion are just kind of these very colorful kind of outlandish stories that we tell to impart nice messages. And that is totally what the Dark Carnival it is. It's all these kind of macabre, sinister figures who are, you know, teach juggalos the idea that you should lead a good life and you should be good to other people and you shouldn't exploit the poor, you shouldn't be racist. And if you do that, you'll go up to heaven, or if you don't do that, you'll go you'll go to Hell's Pit. So yeah, I think there definitely is something to the idea that, you know, there is a spiritual and moral component to it, as well as just a musical or cultural one.
Paul in Newbury, Vermont. Paul, thanks for calling. You're on the air with Nathan Rabin.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'd just like to maybe relay a little message about how I found the Grateful Dead in the 80s, well, late 79 and the 80s, and how it kind of formed my life. So me and my friends, we'd work real hard, and we'd go on tour with the Dead. And we went because the music moved us, and I think the whole scene around it was beneficial, and it was certainly the frosting on the cake, but the music was what we went for. It moved us, we danced hard, we felt good, and we were able to leave our problems at the door, go in, dance hard, sweat, have fun with our friends, a lot of camaraderie, share with the community this music that was really, I think, very deep, and maybe on a borderline spiritual, but not in a hokey way, and yeah. Then you leave, and you did have to pick your problems back up. You went back to work, you made money, and you responsible person, but then when they came around again, you knew you wanted to get in that scene, to get into that music, to almost a release of life. And I do agree with the discussion earlier that, in a way, it is an escape. I mean, I didn't have an easy life when I turned 16, but when I found the Dead at 16, it really started to make my life easier. I became more resourceful. I worked harder for it. I felt like that was my reward, in a way, that music and that release.
Yeah. Formed your life, your words there, Paul. That is one big statement for any musical group. Nathan, as you write, this is not an uncommon reaction or sort of sense coming into and out of these cultures.
No, I think this is kind of a rite of passage for a lot of people. You know, you grow up feeling alienated, you grow up feeling alone, and then you find something that makes sense, and these people who like you and accept you and are having fun and are dancing. I think that's an important part of the whole fish experience. I think people are embarrassed or self-conscious or ashamed to dance in a lot of ways, especially if they're white, perhaps for good reasons. But you go to a fish show and everybody's dancing and nobody's looking at you and nobody is judging you and nobody is saying, gosh, it's silly and self-indulgent to dance. There's just this pure expression of joy that I think is very liberating and is very rare to find in popular culture in particular, which tends to be kind of detached, which tends to be a little ironic, which tends to be a little snarky. There's just this sort of sincerity and embrace of emotion and pleasure that is very refreshing.
We're talking about music's superfan subcultures with Nathan Rabin in Chicago. His new book is You Don't Know Me, But You Don't Like Me. I want to turn this back in time a little bit with the wonderful Alex Ross, music critic for The New Yorker, author of Listen to This, The Rest is Noise. Alex Ross joins us right now from New York. Great to have you with us again, Alex. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. It's good to be back.
So here you are representing all that classical realm, and we're talking about the Insane Clown Posse and Phish and, you know, Bikini Kill. When you look at or think about these contemporary superfan subcultures, first of all, is there an equivalent in the classical world today? And if not today, was there? What? Where? When? Who?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. Obviously, there is intense fandom in the classical world today, but it doesn't really meet up with the kinds of identifiable subcultures that you've been talking about there. There are people who travel around the world seeing Wagner productions, or who become very fascinated by a particular opera singer or a pianist, and will see him or her in a number of different places, but they don't really stand out in a crowd, and they'll sort of blend in to everyone else. You know, the greater part of the audience in any given place will simply be people in that city who go to the opera, who go to concerts.
Was there a time for Paganini or Liszt or you name it?
Yeah, there was. I mean, there was enormous hysteria around some of these super virtuosos of the 19th century. I think it had something to do with the emergence of a middle class marketplace, and these figures, you know, stood out as the most flamboyant, the most fascinating cultural celebrities of the day. And also, I think of the opera singers. Jenny Lind went on this enormous tour of America in the mid 19th century, which was managed by P.T. Barnum. So it was
from my hometown, Bloomington, Illinois. Yeah.
Oh yeah, big show business. And then you had this Wagner phenomenon, and this is really one of the most fascinating cases, because in the latter part of the 19th century, you had a real cult of Wagner, and it was a powerful and influential cult that crossed a lot of geographic borders and also cultural disciplines. Artists in many different fields were mesmerized by Wagner and behaved strangely in Wagner's vicinity in a way that I think, you know, some of the ways that you've been talking about here, these religious conversion experiences where people are suddenly overwhelmed. And one of the most famous cases was Charles Baudelaire, who went to see a series of Wagner concerts in Paris in 1860 and emerged. First, he wrote a letter to Wagner saying that this was the greatest musical pleasure I have ever experienced. And then he wrote this monumental essay, Richard Wagner and Tannhäuser in Paris, where he talks about entering this dream state, feeling these sublime as well as satanic presences in Wagner's music, really completely over the top and yet very influential. I mean, a lot of this vocabulary fed into the emergence of symbolism in literature and painting, and eventually modernism as well. And there's a whole string of artists, writers, as well as just sort of aesthetes and connoisseurs who fell under Wagner's spell.
And let us not forget, ultimately, some sort of troubling political developments, national socialism, Nazi, and all the rest. But let's hear a little bit of this. I mean, you write that, you know, maybe this ties Wagner in with the Insane Clown Posse, but they would even dress as Wagner opera characters in the streets sometime. Just a little bit of that sound is Prelude to Act 3 from Lohengrin. This is Rudolf Kemp and the Wiener Philharmoniker, Richard Wagner. Alex Ross, you say that Wagner, like some of the groups that bring out these great followings today, had his super fans, but was also divisive.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, well, first of all, you mentioned people wearing curious costumes, and I think of the writer and editor Édouard Dujardin, who's considered the originator founder of the stream of consciousness in literature.
Yeah.
And for a while, he was going around with a vest embroidered with tiny swans in honor of Lohengrin. And there were a number of other characters who fit that profile. But yeah, Wagner was very divisive. Politically, there was this contest over what he meant, because, you know, earlier in his career, he acted like a revolutionary. He was very much associated with the left. Later, after the publication of his anti-Semitic writings and his sort of extreme nationalist phase in the 1860s and 70s, he was associated with the right, and that fight went on back and forth into the early 20th century. Hitler really won that battle. He successfully appropriated Wagner for his movement so convincingly that now people still today associate Hitler with Wagner, even though when you look at Wagner's politics, there are a lot of elements that don't fit fascism at well.
Of course.
As well, because deep down, I think Wagner was really kind of an anarchist. He didn't really believe in the organized state, and the organization
right.
of the state is a pretty big part of fascism.
Nathan Raven talks about the dark carnival of the Insane Clown Posse world today. But I mean, even that, Paganini had this sort of a gifted by the devil persona, shtick that people glommed onto.
Before Robert Johnson, people were talking about, you know, did Paganini sell his soul to the devil in order to be able to play the violin that well? Similar stories being told about Liszt. And so there is this, you know, the figure of the charismatic musician fascinates as well as troubles even the most intense fans. And so you find this love-hate relationship.
What was the microculture around Liszt, or what did he bring out in his subculture super fans?
Well, there was just what he did at the piano was just absolutely stunning to everyone who encountered it. But also there was an enormous charisma with the long hair. He was an extraordinarily handsome man in his youth and remained mesmerizing for women as well as men well into his old age, even after he took religious orders and assumed the character of a musical monk to some extent. He still had that charisma. And yeah, in the 19th century, so many of these figures had these sycophants, these worshippers around them, which can really create a very a distorted picture of what these artists were really aiming at. The fans can take over the image of the artist himself or herself.
Nathan Raven, we just got a couple seconds here, but it's not really sycophants you're writing about these days. It's something else.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's about the symbiosis between a band and its fans, you know, that kind of profound spiritual bond that is rare and potent and wonderful.
This has been just wonderful in itself, all the way from right now and into the Wayback Machine. Alex Ross, thank you for taking us back to Paganini and Liszt and Wagner and all the rest. Thanks for being with us, Alex.
Sure, my pleasure.
And Nathan Raven, a wonderful tour you've taken us on. Thanks for letting us go along with you. Just terrific. The new book is You Don't Know Me, But You Don't Like Me, Phish, Insane Clown Posse, and My Misadventures with Two of Music's Most Maligned Tribes. Nathan Raven in Chicago, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. I had a blast.
We'll go out with the man who stepped into yesterday, Phish. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thanks for joining us.